second case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Samuel D. Adams, also known as Dale S. White, Mr. Thomas Sanis, an attorney from Sisseton for the appellant, and Mr. Frank Egan, an assistant attorney general from here for the State of South Dakota. Mr. Sanis, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, counsel, good morning. Today I'm here to represent Sam Adams. Sam Adams, in a nutshell, was convicted of first-degree burglary, first-degree robbery, and aggravated assault last fall by a jury of his peers in Roberts County, South Dakota. The brief facts of the case are that on February 5th of 2001, a local businesswoman was robbed in her store. Approximately $117 to $118 in cash plus three checks were taken from her. The weapon was never recovered. She was hit in the back of the head. The cash was never recovered. The checks were never recovered. The main piece of evidence against my client was that of a card which was left on the counter which said from Sam to Karen. From that card, my client was an immediate suspect of the police, and there was also an eyewitness identification, i.e. the victim.
Well, the card was there because the individual went in to send his sweetie some cards or something, didn't he?
Your Honor, in regards to the card.
Flowers or whatever?
The flowers?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. In regards to the card, it is the defendant's position that that card was planted by the individual who actually committed the crime, by putting a different name on there to lead the police on basically a wild goose chase, Your Honor.
What evidence does he have to support that?
Your Honor, during trial, the key piece of evidence that my client presented was that of his alibi. He was not in the store that day. His father, Dale Adams, supported his alibi, as did his girlfriend at that time, Karen Farmer. It is his position that he never wrote it. The other piece of evidence he has is that the card itself and the pens were submitted for fingerprint analysis here in Pierre. No fingerprints were able to be obtained. At the same time, none were able to be put on the fact that those were Sam Adams. Another key piece of evidence, and this is from the city police officer himself, the chief of police, Chief Flannery, is that there was a bloody footprint at the scene. The shoes that were recovered from the defendant, which the victim went on to testify all the clothes he was wearing the day he turned himself in, were the same clothes that he was wearing the day of the robbery, did not match the bloody footprint. And another thing that must be remembered, from the scene, the victim bled, unfortunately, profusely. They submitted the defendant's clothes, jacket, jeans to the state crime lab here in Pierre for analysis. And that lab reported back that both by visual and chemical means, they were unable to find any type of blood evidence. So this case was extremely circumstantial in nature.
Well, you had an eyewitness identification from the victim, so how can you claim it's circumstantial?
Your Honor, in regards to that eyewitness identification, at this point in time, there were many questions raised about throughout the trial in regards to when she had seen a wanted poster of the client that was placed around town, and also whether there was any other type of photo lineups that were put there by, at that point in time, Sergeant Fisher. Sergeant Fisher is now a patrolman with the Sisseton Police Department. There were questions raised in regards to that. I would also submit to this court that eyewitness identification is something that all across the United States has become a problem, especially when you look at capital punishment trials. I believe Illinois submitted a report where they said that witness identification put numerous people on death row.
Is this an issue?
Is this an issue in this case, eyewitness identification?
What they're doing in Illinois, Ned, I mean, there's no question that this witness testified. Are you saying she was incompetent to testify or what?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that there was circumstantial evidence in regard to the commission of the crime, and I believe that it directly really goes to issue number 5, effective assistance of counsel at that point in time. And I think that even though there was eyewitness identification, I'm not trying to attack the victim at all. But it is my belief, and it was Sam's belief, that she can be mistaken.
I want to let you get to your legal arguments, but tell me about one more thing about the card. What was the defense theory that a particular third-party perpetrator was trying to frame his trials? I didn't read it that way.
Your Honor, I was not the trial counsel, and so I'm not exactly sure the way the different theories went throughout the case.
Okay, well, the reason I ask is, how would this third-party perpetrator, unless it was a framing issue, how would this third-party perpetrator protect notice that you already used the word Sam. I'm curious if it was the criminal defendant.
Your Honor, that's a great question. And in regards to that, what would be out of me would be purely speculation. It would be something that would have to be presented to the trial court and the jury. But basically, the position of the defendant would be in that the individual who committed the crime did know Sam and did know that he was dating Karen Fine and did pin this on him by putting that on there. And in regards to the card, I think it's extremely important to note that the state employed a forensic document examiner. And this document examiner, in her own words, said it was inconclusive as to whether or not Sam was the writer of that card. And in fact, put the estimate at anywhere from 60 to 80% on whether or not he had wrote that card.
Okay, so that evidence went to the jury.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
And so then counsel could argue that it doesn't show beyond a reasonable doubt, raises a reasonable doubt. So what's the problem? I mean, you've got all these facts to argue, and it still goes to the weight in that, doesn't it? And what the jury? And we got a jury that didn't believe your client through his other counsel's version of what went on, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so now we got to get down to where is the error in this?
Well, Your Honor, I believe the first part, if you want me to discuss the card, the main piece of evidence there, that is something the jury could hang their hat on. And I think the fact that counsel did not employ a forensic examiner for himself. Handwriting analysis is not something that everybody just walks out and says, that's obviously Tom Sands' handwriting, that's obviously Joe Bull's handwriting. This is an expert. The state employed him. The state's own expert said 60 to 80%. By best case, then, there's a 40% chance that this may not be the defendant's handwriting. Clearly, in this situation, counsel should have employed the expertise of their own handwriting.
So that
analysis.
Goes to what you're contending is ineffective assistance. He's been denied his right under the Constitution to competent.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we don't know why he didn't do it in this record.
No, Your Honor.
So isn't that usually what we've said? Better left for a later day?
Yes, Your Honor. This court has on numerous occasions stated that we would prefer to address ineffective assistance counsel claims beyond a habeas proceeding. But
if the state's own witness says there's a 40% chance this is not Sam Adams' signature, how can you get any better than that if you're the defense attorney? You can say, well, that's not beyond reasonable doubt, is it, Mr. State's witness?
Sure, Your Honor. If you are competent enough to answer the right questions to the forensic document examiner, you're messing with an expert at that point in time. You're even arguing from what that expert says. I believe, as Justice Saber said in the Connect case, you need to employ somebody to educate yourself so that I will even be knowledgeable if Sam gets a new trial on exactly what the individual characteristics and what the science is.
Well, let's say this. What if this attorney has had three or four other cases involving handwriting, has had all that experience and is very knowledgeable on it? Why would he want to employ anyone based upon his experience? We can always rely on that. We don't know what his experience is right now, do we?
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe, though, with the totality of the circumstances in which everything else be taken into consideration, it does rise to ineffective. And one of the questions you asked, Your
Honor, is casual representation, like in the McBride case, or one of those that we talked about where we did address ineffective assistance on direct appeal. You're saying that this conduct by this attorney rises to that level in this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why?
Well, I think another great example is, let's start right off with the jury selection, Your Honor. The state, in a pretrial motion, asked to supplement their panel based on two facts. A, there appeared to be 10 jurors that may have challenged for cause questions. They did not challenge them specifically, so therefore I do not believe there's a blend violation. Second of all, the state puts in their motion that there are several Native American jurors that appear on the panel. And it's unknown whether they have knowledge or are related to the defendant so as to give rise to challenges for cause. I would submit to this court that that right there is improper and unconstitutional. The fact is, we do not select our juries, Your Honor, based upon race. The moment race was interjected into the pretrial proceedings and the selection of the jury, it tainted it.
Didn't she say she thought they were related to the defendant, though?
They may be related to the defendant, I believe, Your Honor.
Isn't that a proper reason for accusing somebody?
Sure, Your Honor, on voir dire. But she did not say, she did not list them out such as she did with the 10 specific jurors, Your Honor. This person does have a relation. She said they may be related. It's my belief from a review of the record that she did not know. Even with that fact, Your Honor, I ask you to take judicial notice of the fact that there's over 3,000 Native Americans in Roberts County. That's pretty tough to say, well, Native Americans might be related to the guy or might have knowledge of the guy. What about interracial marriages? It's possible that he could be related to numerous Caucasian individuals, numerous African American or Hispanic.
There's a lot of what ifs in this case.
Yes, there is, Your Honor.
But let me ask you, what happened? You know, the best proof of the fact that there is a jury that isn't the proper panel that is through Boyd Dyer. And in Boyd Dyer, does it reflect, in this case, that they were incapable to get a fair and impartial jury to sit on?
Your Honor, I'd answer that question in two parts. The first part, still sticking with the Batson challenge and the race.
There was no Batson.
There was no Batson challenge made, and I'm asking you to take plain error, basically, and rule that that was wrong. The fact is, the jury of his peers was 12 Caucasians, Your Honor. You combine that
with
the
fact... We've never said that, per se.
No, Your Honor.
I'm showing that the jury is not qualified, I would say.
No, but the test is the circumstances that surround it and the inferences. Huge circumstance is the state's own written word. There are numerous Native Americans. Right there off the bat, I mean, that puts the onus on the state.
Did they exclude all Native Americans from the panel?
No, but they struck down three Native Americans by use of their peremptories.
Oh, wait a minute. I can't find any record that those three were not Native Americans.
Yes, Your Honor. And the state does a great job within their brief of pointing that out to the appellant that this issue was not preserved.
Well, the record doesn't establish that there were Native Americans who had done this issue.
I disagree, Your Honor. I think that at that point in time, it was the state of South Dakota that prosecuted Sam Adams. The state of South Dakota knows who they exercised the peremptories on. I think for the state of South Dakota to now submit to this court, oh, we don't know if he struck Native Americans, is disingenuous. I really believe the Attorney General's office and the state attorney are within the same boat on this thing.
Batson, in my prior cases, say the court has no sui responsibility to determine this issue. Now, are you going to create some the state does?
No, Your Honor. What I'm doing in this situation is, first of all, I believe it rises to the level of plain error. And there's where I believe that this court can take judicial notice and reverse it for that reason. Because we do know...
How can it be plain if we don't even know if they're Native Americans?
That's a great question again, Your Honor. And all I have to say is that the reason I know it is because my client told me so. If I'm in front of this court, and I have co-counsel, and my co-counsel has knowledge of something, that knowledge is imputed to me. We're all on the same team. I believe the state at this point in time cannot argue that these were not Native Americans.
You know, when you answer and say that's a great question, you know, that just exemplifies why there is a second hearing on a claim of ineffective assistance, because then you get everybody to come in there and you could specifically ask him about that. And that's why it seems awful. You're asking us to look into a crystal ball, basically, aren't you?
Your Honor, no, I'm not. Because what I'm going to go back to is then if we want to look at the ineffective argument, Your Honor.
Well, it seems all dovetailed together, but go ahead.
It is. And that is, first of all, ineffective, clearly, counsel on the first issue should have at least objected and preserved the record. Most of the state's brief is dedicated to the fact that counsel failed to object or preserve the record or all along these lines of the questions you've been asking. And I believe that if that is going to be the reason that this case is not reversed and remanded, then clearly that is the reason why ineffective assistance of counsel should apply in this case. Also, if we want to go look back at that...
You know, counsel, we don't know the man's reasons. We don't know the attorney's reasons. We don't know what the thinking was, what the strategy was, whatever. Maybe there was none. But that's the reason for the other rule, is that we don't take these ineffective assistance of counsel claims on direct appeal, because you've not yet gone through the steps or the hurdles of having the defense counsel on there and saying, what was your reasoning there? What was your strategy? You haven't given him a chance to defend himself. In relation to the example of the signature or the writing, you know, the proper way to do that is if there was a habeas hearing on that, you would have to show wouldn't change. That, in fact, the writing was, you'd have to bring in an expert to show that that was not Sam's writing, and pretty clearly so. Then you would have to show prejudice. We don't know, in fact, whether or not that defense attorney had three experts look at that. Maybe they all confirmed that it was Sam's handwriting, and so he decided he's better off the way it is. But that's why we require it to be brought on habeas corpus, because why should we jump the gun now and do it in the dark when later on we could be properly informed?
Your Honor, I believe this is a proper case to jump the gun, as you're saying. We have done it before in State versus Cheetah and other cases, and this case...
Let me tell you a story about State versus Cheetah. I was involved in that case. Mrs. Gang was held to be incompetent because she did not notice a witness for rebuttal ahead of time. The reason she didn't is because Mr. Cheetah only told her about that the last day of the trial. She had no previous notice. But because she was denied the opportunity to say that on the stand, she's been branded in the Northwest Reporter forever as incompetent, and she wasn't.
Your Honor, I'm not trying to attack Ms. Gangle.
That's the point. Why doesn't the attorney, no matter how bad it appears on direct appeal, why are they denied the opportunity to explain what happened?
Because I believe the appellant's rights in this situation, Your Honor, are paramount. The appellant, as this court has stated sometimes in its briefs or in its opinions, that should not have to wait for a habeas corpus proceeding if the totality of the circumstances or if the individual instance complained about is so egregious that it warrants a new trial right at this point in time. Sam Adams is serving currently in the South Dakota State Penitentiary. By the time a habeas proceeding could be brought, it could be numerous days, months, numerous years before he has the opportunity to present this defense in a meritorious manner. Therefore, it is appropriate, I believe, for the court to look at it at this point in time. I think a good example of where we have a question is in regards to the jurors themselves, the SAP. I do raise it in the ineffective argument that he did not even attempt to challenge for cause or use peremptories on many of these individuals. So it wasn't necessarily a jury of his peers. Numerous of these individuals were victims of robberies and burglaries, and they were unsolved robberies and burglaries. Now my guy is on trial for a robbery and a burglary. Clearly, this is not...
Didn't those jurors take an oath to decide the case solely on the evidence presented to them?
Your Honor, yes, they did. Just as the individuals that the state used their peremptory challenges on that were Native American. I think that when you look at the totality of the circumstances and the fact that one of the jurors serves in the same choir, picks up police reports, as a state's attorney, a challenge for cause easily could be brought there. One of the jurors had been robbed four times, burglarized. Another juror had been burglarized three times. Another juror had been robbed herself. The juror that ended up hugging the victim during the middle of the trial had her son killed in a domestic violence situation, Your Honor.
She was removed from the tent.
Yes, Your Honor.
She didn't sit on the case.
That's correct, Your Honor. But that shows that even though she had said she could judge us in a fair and impartial manner, that surely within inside her there was conflicting emotions, and that she could not judge this case in a fair and impartial manner.
She didn't, because she was excused.
Correct, Your Honor, but I think that goes directly to what the other jurors had within inside them. And I think that at least a challenge for cause or a peremptory challenge should have been exercised against these individuals.
How do you make that leap from juror A to 2 through 12 that they had something inside them just like A did? How do you get to that point?
Your Honor, because of the questions and the answers that they gave during voir dire. The questions and answers they gave during voir dire went directly to, things that are extremely prejudicial.
So they said the same thing as the juror that was excused.
Your Honor, in regards to that, every juror is going to, nobody gets up on the stand and says, I'm going to be fair, I'm going to be unfair, I'm going to be impartial. People want to be fair and impartial, and I truly believe they try to be fair and impartial.
Have you ever heard a potential juror say they couldn't be fair if they'd already made up their mind?
I'm sorry, sir.
Have you never heard a potential juror look the judge in the eye and say they cannot be fair because they're biased? It happens.
And what I'm submitting to this court is that the general question is that, as a whole, people want to be fair and impartial. And I believe they do. But in this situation, I think there were some definite problems, especially when you go to the fact that they were victims.
And they swear to an oath.
Yes,
and we've said that if they swear that oath, unless you show something, it's pretty hard to overcome the fact that they didn't abide by what they swore they do. So do you really have anything to show that these other jurors didn't follow the oath? Any case for a juror is hard to sit on.
Yes, Your Honor. I cannot present this court with any evidence that is within the record to say they did not. That is true, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, Counsel. Thank you. You have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Geegan, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Can I please the court, counsel? The defendant has raised a number of issues on appeal, and I will attempt to address those in the order in which they're raised. Before doing that, however, the state would like to take just a brief minute to comment on the facts of this case. As indicated by Mr. Sanis, the defendant was convicted of robbery, burglary, and aggravated assault in connection with an incident taking place at a flower shop in Sisson, South Dakota on February 5th of 2001. The defendant apparently would have this court believe that this was a case of mistaken identity. According to the defendant, an individual by the name of Joe Ledfast actually committed a crime. The defendant maintains he was at his father's house at the time in question. What the defendant fails to mention, however, is that the victim had no difficulty whatsoever in identifying him from the photo lineup. She was able to point to his picture almost immediately. When asked if there's any question in her mind whether it was the defendant who had been in her store that day, the victim testified, "I have no doubt that's the man." The record reflects
that there's no challenge to the identification process that she went through whereby it was suggested or anything like that.
There were some indications, as indicated by Mr. Sanis, as to timing when she was shown the wanted poster, what happened.
Was there pretrial motions where that was brought up? Or
yes, it was. And there was evidence in the record that showed that she was not shown those photographs until after she met with Sergeant Fisher and she was sent him the photo array.
Counsel, who was the defense counsel on the trial?
I'll help you. John Brankin.
Okay, John. The record reflects that the victim had ample opportunity to observe the defendant. She testified.
There were only two people at the place.
Exactly, and they spent at least 15 minutes together, which, according to her own testimony, was an unusual amount of time to spend with any one customer. During a portion of that period, they were standing right across the counter from one another, maybe a distance of 2 feet. The victim was adamant that it was the defendant who assaulted her because just prior to the assault, he was standing right next to her. She testified that no one else could come in there in those 2 seconds
and
hit her.
Did she have any physical maladies like bad eyesight or anything like that? Or
nothing
bad memory
that effect,
or anything?
Nothing in the record.
Was shown in the record?
Nothing to that effect in the record. There was also testimony from the victim that she was sure that no one else had entered the store. And she testified that the door to the flower shop made a lot of noise when it was open or closed. And she was positive that she never heard the door open. So it's based on her testimony that the jury obviously elected to convict the defendant on all three counts. The first issue the state wants to touch on is the defendant's assertion that the trial court erred in granting its request to supplement the jury count. According to the defendant, the trial court's decision denied him the right to have a jury selected at random from a fair cross-section of the community. It is alleged the state was thereby allowed to somehow dilute the pool of Native Americans and that this was prejudice in its most pure and simple form. The state would submit, first of all, that this issue has not been properly preserved for appeal. This court has stated on numerous occasions in the past that even a fundamental right may be waived if not raised below. In order to properly preserve an issue for an appeal, an objection must be raised at the trial court level.
An can issue, you raise it on habeas, then?
Exactly.
You can?
Yes.
All right.
In the instant case, the record will clearly reflect the trial court specifically asked defense counsel whether he had any opposition to the state's motion to supplement. In response thereto, defense counsel indicated, "I have no opposition to the state's motion, Your Honor." The state therefore would submit that the defendant, having failed to object and given the opportunity to do so, has waived consideration of this issue on direct appeal.
What did the state mean by referring to potential What was
the state was apparently concerned that there were a number of potential jurors who may have known or related to the victim. That same concern was expressed in connection with potential jurors who knew either the victim or her family. If you look at the state's motion, you will see that that concern was just but one of many reasons advanced by the state's attorney in support of requests for additional jurors. In her motion, the state's attorney undertook, for purposes of illustration, to identify at least 10 jurors who she thought may be subject to challenge for cause. Included were jurors who had a possible bias or prejudice against the attorneys involved in the case. One juror was a former client of the state's attorney.
We all know all that. I'm just concerned about the state of the issue.
But if there are problems with the juror, isn't that usually the time to look at that is when you actually got the people there? I mean, they aren't just per se excluded, are they?
No, the state specifically told the court, and I quote, "I'm not asserting that any one of these people could not be qualified to serve." That same sentiment was expressed in the state's motion itself, but the state's attorney again indicated the state is not challenged for cause or asserting that any of these is biased. That was simply a possibility that the state wanted to explore. She was merely attempting to assure that there was enough of a jury panel in which to select the jury.
So they had a larger jury panel come in then?
Exactly.
And those people were still on it?
Yes.
And then if they called, then you could explore whether or not they did have
explore
any
preconceived. Explore the possibility they knew or related to the defendant.
And just so I'm certain, the supplemental opinion was taken from the master jury list.
Yes. The clerk of courts was directed to summon an additional 40 persons from that jury list.
It was taken from the master jury list?
Yes, it was.
From the master jury list?
Yes, it was.
And there's no dispute to that?
There's no indication otherwise in the record.
Between counsel about this issue. Is that correct?
Correct.
Do we know the racial composition of those 40 jurors?
No. The defendant presented no evidence as to how many jurors on the initial panel were Native American, nor can it be determined from the present record how many Native Americans were on the supplemental panel. Basically, the defendant is asking this court, as in State v. Hall, to merely speculate as to the composition of the respective panels. This court in Hall refused to do that. It was said that if there's any presumption to be drawn from an incomplete record, the presumption is that the trial court acted properly.
Is it the practice there to have the prospective jurors fill out a jury questionnaire which describes things as to what they are as far as race and so forth?
I guess I assume that's a standard typical question in the jury questionnaire. They weren't included in the record, so I couldn't specifically answer that question in this particular case.
Okay.
The other issue the state would like to briefly touch on is the defendant's argument that the state improperly used its peremptory challenges to remove 3 Native Americans from the jury. The state would again submit that the defendants failed to properly preserve the issue for appeal. This court has recognized in the past that the trial court is not required to intervene sua sponte in the jury selection process. Rather, the law requires that the defendant make a timely objection. Absent any such objection by the defendant, there's no record to review. The state would submit that the defendant felt that the state's attorney was using its peremptory challenges to remove Native Americans. The proper procedure would have been to bring that matter to the trial court's attention so that a proper record could be made. Even if this court were to act pursuant to the defendant's invitation to consider this issue via the plain error doctrine, the state would submit that the burden is on the defendant to establish prejudice. He hasn't carried that burden in the instant case. In order to establish a Batson violation, the defendant must show that the state's attorney used peremptory challenges to remove jurors who belong to a recognized racial group and did so based on race. Here, there's no indication in the record that the 3 jurors identified by the defendant were even members of a cognizant racial group. Aside from the defense assertions, there's nothing in the record which would show that these individuals were in fact Native American. If you look at the record, most of the record shows is that one juror, Gene Heminger, testified or indicated that he worked with Sisseton, Wahpeton Housing Authority. The state would submit that that alone doesn't suffice to establish one's race. As indicated in the state's brief, one does not have to be a tribal member or Native American for purposes of employment. As for the other 2 jurors, Beverly Gill and Nina Johnson, the record only reflects that both women had read about the case in a tribal newspaper. The state would submit that it would take an equal leap in logic to say that you can determine a person's race based solely on a newspaper that...
Well, I used to subscribe to the tribal newspaper when I lived up there, so I didn't show much of it.
Exactly. State's point exactly, Your Honor.
Does the record reflect that Gilbertson is not Native American?
Even if it could be sued for purpose of argument that those three individuals were Native American, the defendant still hasn't made out a case of prima facie discrimination. This court has recognized that not all peremptory strikes of minority persons are for racial reasons. The defendant has to point to facts and circumstances which indicate that they're removed based on race. Here, a review of the record indicates the state's attorney had race-neutral reasons for at least two of the jurors.
Now, you say that they waived at this point. Is that something that can go back into on habeas?
Yes.
So we could get the race of these three jurors on habeas?
Both defense counsel could testify, defendant could testify, and presumably the state's attorney could testify.
You know, when you argue that everything's waived, does that kind of...
Dovetail into
ineffective? I mean, these are pretty critical issues that if you have done anything, you know that are, especially in different areas, are pretty critical to represent your client on, aren't they?
The defense argument as far as the motion supplement to jury count.
Well, are they or aren't they? I know. I mean, they are critical issues.
Critical issues, but obviously defense counsel, if given the opportunity to explain and finish the actions, they very well testify there's nothing.
That there's tactic there,
right.
Is what you're saying.
Tactic or nothing which would suggest to him that the state's motion is racially motivated. The other issue the state would like to touch on is this argument concerning juror misconduct. The record reflects that on the third and final day of the trial, one of the jurors, a Gladys Backman, did approach the victim and gave her a hug. The defendant argues that this incident shows or is indicative of a predisposition in Ms. Backman's part to a finding of guilty. This court, however, has indicated that not every instance of juror misconduct warrants a new trial. Any presumption of prejudice said to arise may be rebutted if it is shown that the misconduct did not have any substantial effect in view of the evidence presented and the defendant wasn't prejudiced thereby. In the instant case, the record discloses that the trial court granted the defendant's request to have Ms. Backman excused as a juror. She was brought into chambers and told that under the circumstances she was being excused before the service. She was specifically admonished by the court not to have any further discussions with any of the jurors as to why she was leaving. When asked if he was satisfied with the court's proposal to dismiss her as a juror and appoint an alternate, defense counsel said he, "No, Your Honor, that would be satisfactory to us, the defense." The defendant himself was asked by the trial court if he was satisfied with the court's proposed resolution and responded that he was. The defendant, therefore, was simply in no position to complain that the trial court should have granted a mistrial. If there was any error, the defendant certainly contributed to it. Moreover, the defendant has not shown that he suffered any actual prejudice as a result of this incident. After a verdict had been rendered, the trial court brought each of the jurors into chambers individually and undertook to question them, one, whether they had observed the incident with Ms. Backman, two, whether they had heard about the incident involving Ms. Backman, and three, whether that incident had any effect on the decision-making process. All of the jurors, with the exception of Ms. McCoy, indicated that they did not even know, were not even aware that this had taken place. Ms. McCoy testified that she had been following Ms. Backman into the courthouse when she saw the incident when she hugged the victim. Ms. McCoy, however, simply elected to turn and go the other way. When asked by the court if that affected the decision-making process, she responded, "No, it did not." The defendant, therefore, has not shown that this had any perceptible impact at all on a jury's verdict. Now, unless there's any further questions, I realize there's time.
Well, we can't let you go. Really, but let me ask just this. I'm reading through this, and they asked for an investigator, which isn't uncommon, is it? And I'm sure that this is an indigent defendant, and that you have to go in and present the court your reason for needing it for the assistance. And the thing I noted in there is that the court says that if your client needs someone, give the names to the state, so those interviewed individuals can be interviewed by the sheriff or whoever. Is that the type of procedure that we should be condoning? I mean, the state doesn't have to go in and have the court approve who they want to interview and then give it to the defendant to go out and interview. Is that fair to you?
Several responses. One is that statement, obviously, stemming from the court's concern whether or not the penitentiary would allow an investigator to sua sponte come in and interview each and every inmate. Okay, absent identifying a specific inmate who may have overheard the supposed admission by a Joe Ledfast. The record also reflects that the state's attorney herself indicated to the court that she had specifically asked the defendant and defense counsel for names of where they were getting these rumors. The state's attorney specifically told the court that all she got back, or also kept hearing, was the rumors were coming from the defendant's father, the defendant's mother. The state's attorney went so far as to have local law enforcement interview inmates who had been released from penitentiary as to whether they heard any admissions by Joel Ledfast. The record should also reflect...
But that doesn't address Justice Anderson's question. He's asking, how can the defense ever be required to rely on the state to do the investigation? That's not a policy.
What the court was indicating is that the state, the DCI, had already investigated, interviewed a number of inmates at the penitentiary with regard to whether or not they had overheard this supposed admission by Joe Ledfast.
But the point is a criminal defendant required to rely on the state's investigators? That's not a proposition of law, that's a statement.
But again, I mean, the defendant hasn't shown any actual prejudice, even assuming what you're saying is correct.
Well, he had an alibi, and he claims somebody else did.
If you look at the alibi, it's based on a statement obtained from his father. His father indicated that he had left his home before, approximately 2 hours before noon, and arrived back at the apartment sometime approximately around 12:30 thereafter. The victim testified that the incident in question happened at precisely around noon, which gave the defendant more than ample opportunity to commit a crime.
Well, are you saying that in this case, you review the record, what the trial court is really saying that the defendant did not make a good enough showing to be entitled to have an investigator appointed, or what?
Exactly. The appointment of an expert.
What does exactly mean?
The appointment of an expert lies within the sound discretion of the trial court. The trial court is not required to grant defendant's request each and every time the request is made. The defendant bears the burden of establishing a legitimate need for such an expert. In this particular,
so you're saying the trial court said he didn't need it, but by the way, as a bonus, if you want someone interviewed, tell the state and we'll do it.
If you have any additional names that you want the state to pursue, provide that information to the state's attorney. There's no indication that any additional names were provided to the state.
I haven't had a chance to look at the transcript yet. I've read the briefs. Did the sheriff testify at the trial as a witness for the state?
Sheriff?
Yep.
Yes, he did.
All right. Well, actually, it was the DCI that was supposed to do the investigation.
Correct.
Did they investigate these rumors?
That's unclear from the record. The only thing I can glean from the record is that apparently inmates at the penitentiary were interviewed, and no one overheard the statements.
After the motion, did DCI go out and investigate these rumors?
There's no indication to that effect in the record, so I'm not in a position to answer your question.
Is there anything in the record to show whether or not the fruits of the investigation was turned over to defense counsel?
Again, not that I, to okay. my knowledge. The purpose of the investigation, okay, the request for an investigator by defense counsel, was to pursue the supposed rumors that Joe Ledfast had made admissions that he committed these crimes. If you look at the record, the victim was specifically asked whether or not her assailant had any identifying characteristics, and she responded in the negative. There was testimony in the record, however, that Joe Ledfast had tattoos all over his body, including his hands and knuckles, which were visible even though he was wearing a long sleeve shirt.
Was there any third party perpetrator instruction given in this case that you know of?
Not that I'm aware of.
Any further questions for Tom?
State will close by asking the defendant's conviction be affirmed in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Deegan. Mr. Sanders, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Getting right back to the Batson issue and the issue raised with the supplemental jury panel, I think it's clear in this case, or at least from the appellant's perspective, that our main concern is under a Batson type of challenge, we have to show, A, my client's Native American. We've done that.
B, the question has to show that the state's attorney removed individuals that are of Native American descent. That is a question in which we have discussed. The third thing that we have to really go ahead and look at is circumstantial evidence and the inference that goes to show that there was some type of improper reasoning behind it. And in this case, there is extremely clear. Many of the cases the state cites to within their brief is where it's systematic or where we're just looking at, is there enough folks on there? Here, there was an overt act by the state, specifically within their motion where they show there's numerous Native Americans. We don't know if they're related to or if they have knowledge.
Is there any other evidence in the record, apart from the three lines in that two-page motion, which show in context that the state was asking racially motivated questions or had such motives in the Fort Dyer or any other part of the jury selection process?
No, Your Honor.
So your case rises and falls on those three lines in the motion.
That and the inference that I do believe. Why did the state's attorney, if you go through the voir dire, she did not ask anybody else except Mrs. Johnson if you read anything in the tribal paper, the Shota. She didn't ask that of anybody else except of Mrs. Johnson. I think that shows there the circumstances and the inference that she was Native American.
That motion, as I understand, is made just to get a larger panel, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
It wasn't made to remove them before they even showed up, was it?
Well, Your Honor, that's the question that unfortunately is left to ponder because we don't know what the type of folks that were drawn in. We can't tell who was then drawn to the jury box. And I think then that directly goes
can't
to...
Can't tell? Can't you tell who was supplementally called in to serve as a juror?
Your Honor, from the record, I do not believe you can. I did submit as an additional exhibit, which the state consented to, was the number of witness or the names of the jurors who were actually got into the box and they used the strike.
Well, let me ask you this, and clarify it for me. Is when that motion was made, there had to be a jury panel.
Yes.
Because otherwise you wouldn't know that there's such and such on there, right? Is that a fair thing?
I would agree so, Ron.
So then, when the jurors show up, you can look at who is the jurors that sign in to be a potential juror, right?
Yes, Ron.
And then you can see if there's a difference between the first to get to the second and can tell from that makeup, couldn't you?
I would agree in theory, yes you could, Your Honor.
Okay.
The problem...
Well, not theory, that just seems like common sense to me. But.
Right. The problem here is, Your Honor, is I still think it goes back to affecting the reputation, the fairness, and the public integrity of the courts in Roberts County. I think it's extremely important. The state's attorney, what does it matter if you're Native American, Caucasian, Black, Mexican, female, male, it does not matter. If you had the 10 things on there and you were concerned, then leave it at that. Why put in the extra provision about Native Americans? I believe that's extremely important. And I believe that really goes to what the fairness and the integrity and the public reputation of the judicial system is. And in regards to the ineffective assistance, the entire time is waived, not submitted in record, not preserved. Well, then what does Sam Adams have in working for him? A motion is made where it directly brings up race. In violation of the Constitution, our own code, and the U.S. Constitution. Second of all, it is our assertion that three Native Americans are peremptory for what we believe to be no good reason. Okay. Third of all, he doesn't get a private investigator. He's told to go use the state and turn his names over to there. We haven't talked about Randy Hiska. The state's own witnesses said, yep, Randy Hiska was a witness. Did you interview him? No. We don't know anything about Randy Hiska. We don't know what his characteristics are, and the defendant was foreclosed from doing that. Fourth of all, then we have a juror that comes up and hugs the victim during the trial. Then we have another juror who witnessed it and doesn't report it. And then we still have the other juror that's dismissed. She comes back in the jury room that's crying, and all the jurors notice it. Surely that cannot help the defendant in this case. Finally, you have the state's own expert witness during a motion hearing, or by the assertion of the state, saying it's a 60 to 80% chance that it's handwriting. Well, that means there's a 40% chance that it's not. And the defense counsel, if he's asking for an expert witness to go out and investigate folks, surely he doesn't have the money to go out there and hire an expert witness for the handwriting analysis.
Well, he could have made a motion for one.
Certainly, Your Honor, and he should have. And that's part of my ineffective assistance argument, because then he would have been educated. Then he could have gone up and thoroughly attacked the state's witness or prepared his own defense. with that witness. I mean, this is all science.
What if he was afraid that he might get a witness that says it's 88 9/10% sure it is his signature? That wouldn't be good lawyering, would it?
No, Your Honor, it would not. There's a great case there with DNA. DNA evidence is a very common thing in today's court system. And in the cases that, in fact, the state cites to, they look at, did they get a DNA expert? Why did they, what did they submit their report on? I mean, at least there they make the attempt. At least there they make the motion. Here there's none. Just say, well, we'll submit to the state's expert. That's what's in the record. Truly, how can that be a fair trial for the defendant? When all of those things taken together, how can he appear that he had a fair trial?
How about if I'm a lawyer and I get all the state's evidence and I say, boy, okay, here's one thing where they're a little weak on. They've left me a door. So I think I'm going to try to use that door to raise that element of reasonable doubt. You know, that's a tactic, wouldn't it be?
It would be a tactic, Your Honor. And, I mean, as defense attorneys constantly, you know, the state does a good job. I mean, we're not up here to say the state doesn't prepare its cases. Everybody in the South Dakota State Penitentiary is not guilty. And the defense does have a hard job. But in this situation, the defense has a burden to educate himself, to educate the jury, to check in all possible means, especially when we have a circumstantial case such as this. Excluding the eyewitness testimony, the footprint doesn't match. The same clothes just by circumstance when my guy voluntarily turned himself in from tribal land, voluntarily came in to prove himself innocent with the two alibis. I think that's important to look at. The weapon was never recovered. The money was never recovered. The checks were never recovered.
And that all went to the jury. And your client, through his counsel, was able to argue all those weaknesses. And the jury decided that his version was incredible. And his witnesses. Is that what happened here?
Your Honor, these issues did go to the jury. Were they presented in the proper light? We have the disagreement on, especially when it comes to the handwriting analysis. The jurors that were picked, why not at least give a challenge to cause to someone who sings in the same small town choir of Sisseton, South Dakota, as the church that the state's attorney goes to? Why not raise a challenge for cause to that? We've discussed, I mean, the relations with the attorney, the relations with the victim. I mean, one of the individual's husbands works at the victim's place on the video lottery machine, does video lottery machine work back and forth. That's in the record. These individuals have been burglarized. They're victims. Wouldn't that be like putting the 20th hijacker, having some of his jurors be the Oklahoma City bombing or World Trade Center bomber victims? I mean, I don't think that's what we're looking for. These were victims, not peers. The individuals that the state themselves removed, the Native Americans that we submit, Gene Heminger, Beverly Gill and Nina Johnson, they all said they could be fair and impartial. If necessary, they could return a finding of guilt in this case. What reason was there to exclude them? I think that at this point in time, when you add those circumstances together, and the fact of the state's own written word, we're not arguing like in Arguello, where the jurors that were coming up and the defense looked at it and said, hey, there's not enough Native Americans on here. Here we're looking at where the state says, whoa, numerous Native Americans. So they must be related or have knowledge or may have questions about that. But there's 3,000 Native Americans in Roberts County. There should be numerous Native Americans on the panel. There should be a chance that maybe they're related or have knowledge. That's where Vordire goes to, Your Honor. And I really believe that in this type of situation, it rises to the level of plain error where this court should reverse and remand it and give Sam Adams an opportunity for a new trial so he can present these things, so he can present them through competent counsel, and that these issues are not left just to burn, unfortunately, until he has a habeas counsel appointed and a chance to burn at that point in time.
You know, counsel, that he could have waived his direct appeal and brought a habeas corpus matter and would have got a ruling from the trial court probably faster than he'd get a ruling from the Supreme Court.
That's a good point.
But he's waiving something.
He's waiving the right to have it presented.
Direct appeal.
And it's tough to waive your rights, especially when you're coming up in front of this court for the first time. And I think for Sam Adams, that's what he is looking at. We respectfully request that you reverse and remand this decision.
What you're saying is you didn't want to be in a position to come up here on a habeas saying you didn't take that up on direct appeal and you should have, is what you're saying.
Correct, Your Honor. You're darned if you do, you're darned if you don't.
Well, you did. And we thank you, and your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.